So we're going to look at the PowerPoint on logical if statements. And as I said, if statements are kind of like queries that we do in Access. Okay? The difference is in Access, we're querying to see if we should display. And if the answer is no, we do nothing. Okay? We do nothing. Okay. Thank you. So if the answer is no, we do nothing. Whereas lots of times when the answer is no in regular coding of programs, it just means do something different. It doesn't mean do nothing. So in this case, we actually have a do nothing. I'm saying if amount is greater than 5,000, then take amount, multiply it by 10, and put it into answer. Okay, so again, in Access, we were looking at much more of a display. Now we're looking at more choosing what kind of processing to do. So if amount is greater than 5,000, take amount, multiply it by 10, and put it in answer. If it's not greater than 5,000, do nothing. Now when you draw the flowchart, the diamond asks the question. The rectangle does processing. I always, and I recommend you do it because most people do, have the yes go off to the right and the no go off to the left. And the reason for being careful about that is you're going to forget to put Y's and N's on half the time. And so if you always go off to the right with a yes and always go off to the no with the left, then it's easier to remember when you don't put your Y's and N's in. So the way I code this in flowcharts and the way I code it in pseudocode. So in pseudocode, I said if amount is greater than 5,000, take amount, multiply it by 10, and assign it to answer, end if. Okay, so I show the if and I show the end if. And that's how I do it in flowcharting and pseudocode. On the next one, I've got something I want to do if it's a no. So I'm saying if amount is greater than 5,000, do one calculation. Otherwise, do another calculation. So if I get a yes, I'm doing one calculation for answer. If I get a no, I'm doing another calculation. And when I come down here, I say if amount is greater than 5,000, do one calculation else. Okay, so else is the no. Else tells me what to do if I get a no. If I get a yes, I do one thing. Else, I do something else. And then I show the end of the if statement using the end if. Now, when you come to putting these in languages, some languages have an end if. Other languages put the contents inside curly braces or do something to show what to do if it's true, what to do if it's false. But they all have something that will show that, what to do if it's true and what to do if it's false. Okay, on this next one, I've got two things in an and relationship. And that's something you saw in Access. If I have two things on the criteria line, they are in an and relationship. Okay, one or the and the other, both of them have to be true. So if I have a field called inventory code and I put an A in the criteria line, and I have a field called amount and I put greater than 5,000 in the criteria line, I'm looking for every record that has a code of A and an amount greater than 5,000. So this is an and relationship. And if it's true, I move OK to message. Okay? So down here in pseudocode, I ask if inventory code equals A. And if it does, I drop down and ask the next question. If the code is an A, I'm out of here. I drop down to the end if. But if the code is A, I ask, is amount greater than 5,000? If it is, I move OK to message. And then I end that if. And there should have been quotes around the OK in both places. But this is pseudocode, so you can make stupid mistakes in pseudocode. It's not the real thing. Okay, so that's how I can write the pseudocode for that. Questions? Now, this one can be made into a compound because I'm saying if inventory code equals A and amount is greater than 5,000, move OK to message. So I can code it with an AND because I have got two compounds. If the answer is no to either one of them, I want to do nothing. So I don't have any else's. I just have, if they're both true, move OK to message. And those are in an AND relationship. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to go in and I'm going to, I'm going to put things in the no. And this is something that is different from what we did in Access. Because I'm having what do I want to do if it's true? What do I want to do if it's not true? So if inventory code equals A, the yes asks a whole second question. And the whole second question is embedded over there. So if inventory code equals A, I then ask, is amount greater than 5,000? And if it is, I move OK to message. If it's not, I move problem to message. Okay? If I get a no to the inventory code, I move problem to message. So notice how this sets up. I have an if embedded in an if. And when I read it, the else locks itself on to the first available if going up, and the end if does too. So those go in there. If amount is greater than 500, move OK to message. Else, move problem. Then the else down here can't have that if it's already got something, so it attaches itself to that if. It attaches to the first available if. And the end if also attaches to that. So I'm saying if inventory code equals A, I'm asking a whole nother question embedded inside. If inventory code is not equal to A, I take the else and I move problem to message. And I end my if. Because these two are the same, I can do a compound. If they weren't the same, I couldn't do a compound. If they were doing different things, I couldn't do a compound. But because they're the same, I can. So I'm saying, if inventory code equals A, and amount is greater than 5,000, move OK to message. Else, move problem to message. And that has to be the same because the no for the code A and the no for the amount both have to go to the same place. Why? Because I've asked them together. So I said, if this and this are true, move okay. Else. Else means one of them's not true, or maybe they're both true. Okay? But if I have both not true, I'm sorry. If I get an else, that means I got a problem. Either this is not true, or the amount is not true, or they're both not true. Okay? So those are the same. If those are different, then I have different responses to the no's, which means I would have to have a different response to each of them. I need to have them separate if I'm going to have a different response. So I can only make a compound if they're the same. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
just one or two heads going, yeah. Questions? You sure there's no questions? It makes me nervous when people don't ask questions. Okay. Yeah. Ooh, good. I got a question.
Okay. Could you not have one of the more problems message and it would still be valid?
Sure. And in fact, I'm going to actually do some different ones. So this is the next one that I'm doing where I took it out and I said, I'm only going to move problem to message here, but I'm not going to have it there. So if code is not an A, I don't want to do anything. Okay? If code is an A, then I want to check his amount greater than 500. And depending on the answer to that, I've got two different things I can do. But in this one, I said, if all code is an A, I don't want to do anything. I'm only dealing with code equals A people today, or items today. Is that a solid answer?
Yes.
Okay. So this cannot be a compound because the no's are different. So if I wrote a compound and said, if inventory code equals A, and amount is greater than 5,000, move OK to message, else. And now I got a problem. What do I put in the else? Do I put nothing so I don't even have an else? Or do I put a message? And so that's why it can't be a compound, is it's not clear what to do if I get the else, if I get a no to the compound question. Okay, and over here on this one, I put different messages. So again, I can't have a compound because a compound gives me one else. Which message do I choose to put out? So I have to do it broken down. If inventory code equals A, then ask about amount. If amount is greater than 5,000, move OK. Else, move problem. In that if, then the else over there goes with inventory code. So if inventory code is not A, I want to move bad code to message. Well, these two are different. And so since they're different, I can't have a compound. Because a compound says either one or both. I don't care. If you didn't get a yes to the question, this is what I want to do. Well, I haven't got a clear answer of what I want to do if I get a compound. Okay. So again, I would write the if and say if inventory code and amount move okay, else, and then I don't know what to do because I've got these two things and which one do I choose? Well, I'd be wrong if I chose either one of them. So that's why I need to have separate if statements on this one. So I can accommodate different no's. Okay? Questions? Comments? Anything? Tony's my favorite person right now because she asked a question. So would somebody else like to be a go to the head of the class? Okay. That was an and relationship. Now we're getting into an or relationship. And I'm saying if inventory code equals A, or amount greater than 100, 5,000, we'll get it yet, if amount greater than 5,000. One or the other, okay? So if this is true, I say move okay. If this is true, I say move okay. I don't care which one. One or the other has to be true. So I ask if inventory code is A, move OK to message. Else, okay, else is the no. Else is amount greater than 5,000. If it is, move OK to message. If not, I don't have an else because I don't do anything. Okay? So I end that if, and then I end the other if. Okay? If I'd had something to put in the no, then I would have an else on the inner one. But I didn't. I didn't do anything if I got a no to the inner question. So I don't have an else there. Could this be made into a compound? Could I say if inventory code equals A or amount greater than 5,000? Could I do that? Yeah. Because the answer is the same. So since the answer is the same, I can make that a compound. Because I don't care which one I get a yes to. If I get a yes to one of them, I want to put out move OK to message. And in fact, I'll never know if I get a yes to both of them. Because if I get a yes to the first question, I never even bother to ask the second question. Because I only need a yes to both one of them. And if I get it for both, that's fine. But I don't need it. And so this just shows the compound. If inventory code equals A or amount greater than 5,000, move OK message. And if. Okay. And again, the quote should be on the other side of the OK. Copy and paste is a wonderful thing. Okay, and that missing quote will keep coming back to haunt me. Okay, here I said, if inventory code equals A, move OK to message. If it isn't, ask about amount, and if it's greater than 5,000, move OK to message. And if not, move problem to message. Can this be a compound? Somebody make a stab at it.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because if I can write it as if inventory code equals A or amount greater than 5,000, move OK to message, else move problem to message. Okay, else move problem to message. So this can be a compound. And in fact, there it is. Okay, so I'm saying if inventory code equals A or amount is greater than 5,000, move OK to message, else move problem to message. What about this one? Could this be a compound? No, why?
Because you have two different answers.
That's right. Because if I say if inventory code equals A or amount greater than 5,000, move, oops, what do I move? Okay, I've got two different possibilities there. So that can't be made a compound because I don't want to treat them the same. I'm treating them differently. So this one is asking if inventory code equals A, move code OK. Else, if amount is greater than 5,000, move amount OK. Else, I've got a problem. Notice how one entire question is embedded in the else. Now we've had one entire question embedded in the if. So I can embed a whole second question. If it's no, I have a whole second question to deal with. Okay. Okay. This is the one that if I have sent anything back to you from the research access database, it was probably 5 and 7. And I said 5 and 7 was a problem. And 5 and 7 are the ones where I say one thing has to be true and either of two other things. Okay, one has to be true and either of two other things. Okay? So, that's the same as this. Inventory code has to be an A. If it's not, I'm out of here. Okay? If inventory code is not an A, I'm out of here. So that has to be true. Inventory code has to be an A. And if inventory code is an A, then I say, okay, if amount first is greater than 500, move okay. If no, if amount second greater than 200, if so, move okay. So I'm saying one thing has to be true and either of two others. So if I were to write this in Access, and I have inventory code, and I have amount first, and I have amount second. And this is the criteria line in Access, and this is the OR line. So this was being done in Access. So that's the criteria line, and that's the OR line. So how would I make this problem show up in Access? If inventory code equals A, and either of the others true, I want to display. So how would I enter this in Access? Yeah.
You have to check for inventory code in A in both the criteria and the
right.
OR. Then amount first in the criteria, and then amount second in the OR.
Yep. So I have to say inventory code in both the criteria and the OR line because it has to be true. And then and either amount first greater than 500 or amount second greater than 200. Okay? And that would mean I would in Access display. Here it means I would move OK to message. Okay, because I'm doing a different kind of processing. So both things have to be true. Inventory has to be true, is what I meant to say. And either of the other two. Okay? Questions? So again, if I sent you back 5 and 7... on the research database, this is the same general logic. One thing has to be true in either of two others. Now, could this be made a compound? Yeah, because as long as this is true and one of these is true, I move okay to message. So I can make it a compound. Now we're going to have to get into how to make it a compound. Okay, so there's the compound. And remember the rule that ands get resolved before ors. And also, the parenthesis can change the order. Okay. So parenthesis can change the order. So I have up here, inventory coding was A, and either, and the parentheses basically act like an either, and we saw this in SQL. If you've done the SQL assignment, or just RSQL in class, you saw the situation where one thing had to be true and either of two other things. The either of two other things go in parentheses, which means that if I have the parentheses there, I resolve that parenthesis first and say, okay, one of those is true. And then I say, okay, A has to be true and one of those. Okay? So I can do this in compound, but I have to have the parenthesis. Question. Okay, continuing along with this theme, the next one, I wrote it this way. I said the thing that has to be true first, if inventory code equals A. And then I said, okay, now if inventory code is A, is amount first greater than 500 or amount second greater than 200? And I wrote it using two if statements. And if both of the if statements get a yes, I move OK to message. So that's another way of writing it. Questions? Yeah. Say that again, yes, because I asked if twice. If I ask if twice, then I gotta end it twice. Okay? Just so I can keep track of. Because these can get pretty complex. And if you don't keep track of every if with an end if, you can go off and do la la land very easily. Where was I? There. Okay, now on this one, I took out the parenthesis. And when I take out the parenthesis, these two get resolved together, and this one stands alone. So I'm saying this and this, or just that one. Just that one. So basically it stands alone. So what I do when I put this into the flowchart is I said if inventory code equals A and amount first is greater than 5,000, I want to move OK to message. Okay. If I don't get a yes to those two, I've got this standalone thing I got to deal with. And when I deal with this standalone thing, I can say no to both of my questions and ask the standalone. So a no to inventory code equals A, ask the standalone question. A no to amount first greater than 500, ask the standalone question. Because if I don't get the combination, the grouping of those two, then I can ask the standalone question. Those get grouped. And if I don't get a yes to the group, then I can ask the standalone question. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense to everybody. Please ask. Like asking the same question twice because I'm basically lazy. So if I turn this around and ask the standalone question first. Is the non-second greater than 200? If it is, move okay. And then they ask the compound group question next. It's a lot easier code. So if you've got something that stands alone, it's a lot easier to ask it first. And just say, is the non-second greater than 200? If not, then I'll ask the group question. So that's just another way of doing it. If the parentheses aren't used. Okay, now I'm back to this one, and I have put a no in for one of the no's, but I've left the other no with nothing in it. Okay? So, I can't make this a compound because these two, there's nothing here. So not the same. And as it turns out, these two are not the same. So I can't make it a compound. Once I start getting my actions different, then I have to process each action separately. So those aren't the same, so I can't make it a compound. So I have to ask each question separately. If inventory code is equal to A, if I get a no to that, I'm out. So I just drop right out. If it's true, then I ask the next question. Is amount first greater than 500? If it is, I move 500 okay. If it's not true, then I ask a whole other question. Is amount second greater than 200? And if that's true, I move 200 okay. Otherwise, I decided to move our problem. Okay. So I had to do those separately. And then I come to the last one, where I put something in every place. So now, inventory code equal to A, it's no, got an else move. Okay, so it's no, got an else move. So now I have something for everything. But it can't be a compound because these two are different and these two are different. So it can't be a compound. Okay. Questions? Does it make any sense whatsoever? Okay, some people are being honest. Does it make sense to anybody? Yay! I got two or three. Ask questions then. Or I'm going to end up torturing you with a homework assignment. I will anyway, so. But ask questions.
We're going to look at more of these kinds of things on Tuesday when we're going to do an exercise. So that will probably help too.
This is probably one of the hardest parts of the course, is getting this logic stuff down. And so, Joe is willing to work with it at 2 o'clock, so hang around if you're having problems. And go back over this PowerPoint, because it does show a lot of the basics. So, I've done my best. Without questions, I can't do any better. So, do you have questions? I'm flunking. Yeah.
Just go over 17 again.
Yep, 17. Yeah, you picked the most complicated one. Okay, 17. I said, what if what I wanted was inventory code A and amount first greater than 500? Or just, okay, so these two, did I want these two together? Or just that one, all by itself? Or just that one? And again, this may have been what I wanted. It also might have been what I got when I forgot to put in the parentheses. But this maybe is what I wanted. Maybe I wanted inventory code equal to A and amount first greater than 500, or just amount second greater than 200. So I started asking the question, if inventory code equals A and amount first is greater than 500, that's the two things right there, then move OK to message. I'm OK. But if I didn't get a yes to both of those and get OK, I would have got a no to one of them. And the no to this and the no to this both have to ask that standalone question. So if I don't get a yes to both of them, then I've still got that standalone question about amount second, and I've got to ask it. So I ask it, if I get a no to the question about the code, I ask about amount second. If it's greater than 200, move OK. If I get a yes to inventory code, but I get a no to amount first greater than 500, I got a not going to be able to display, but I got another chance, and that's the standalone question. So I ask the standalone question. So in other words, if the group together wasn't satisfactory, then I've got to ask the standalone question. Does that help any? Now, the next one, what I said was, I hate to ask the same question twice, so if I turn these around and say, I'm going to ask this one first, and then I'll ask about the group, then it's a lot easier to write. And it doesn't make any difference. I can do it either way. So on the next one, what I did on 18 is I asked the just question first. So I said, this again is just this or these together. And I said, you know what? I'm going to ask the standalone just question first. And if I get an okay to that, I'm done. But if I get a no to that, then I have to ask the together question. And these are the together things. So I have to ask the together alone. This is the alone. Just. So that's another way when I could have chosen to do it. Is ask the standalone question first, and then it's just a lot cleaner. Questions? Okay. We will be coming back to this several times, not this flowchart, but looking at it from different perspectives. So hopefully, after we've looked at it from a couple of different perspectives, it will start making sense. So I am going to leave this and see if I can confuse you another way. So I'm going to do a presentation on loops. Again, remember that what I said was last time that there are three kinds of things. Programming logic involves three structures. And this is the thing I said I guarantee will be on your final. Sequence means do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. Just keep doing them. That's sequence. Selection means choose. Ask a question and act differently depending on the answer to the question. And loop says, check if you need to do it. If you do, do it. Then go back and check again. If you need to do it, do it. Then go back and check again. And you just keep doing this loop over and over and over again. And those are the three structures that we run into. So the first one is a loop where I am asking a condition. And when I get an answer to that condition, if it's yes, I process and then go back and ask the question again. And if I get a yes, I process and then I go back and ask again. Sooner or later, I'm going to get a no, hopefully, and then I drop out. Okay, so then I drop out. The other way I can do that is, well, actually, let me just one other thing. In this one, it's possible I never process. Because I check first. When I check, if it tells me no, don't process, then I don't process. So let's say I was reading a file, or I wanted to read a file, and the file was empty. And so the condition was, is there records on the file? And I got a no to that because the file was empty. I just dropped out and I never did any processing. If I got a yes to it, I went and processed. Okay? But if I got a no, I just dropped out. So it's possible that I will never process in this particular one. In the next one, I process first. So I will always process at least once. On this one, I always process at least once. And the thing is that I process before I check. So that's why I'll process at least once. I process and then I check. And if I get a yes to the check, I go back and I process again. And then I ask the question, and if I get a yes, I go back and process again. And when I finally get a no to that question, I'm out of there. But notice that I process before I check. So since I process before I check, I always process at least once. Okay. So if the condition is below the processing, I always process at least once. So for example, and this is a little of what we talked about last Tuesday. An initializing read. If I am reading a file, the initializing read reads one record. And then I say, as long as it's not in the file, meaning as long as the read was successful. Okay, in the file meant it didn't hit anything, it didn't have anything to read. So I do an initializing read, and as long as it's not in the file, I process, and then I read the second record. And as soon as I read the second record, I go back and check. Is it not in the file, meaning did I read successfully? If I read successfully, I process and then I read again. Then I go back and check. If it's not in the file, I process, read again, go back and check. Eventually, when I read, I will hit the end of file indicator. So we'll come back and not in the file, we'll get a no, and it will drop out. Okay? So that's how I do a loop. So if we look at the next one, I can have it that I am processing a file, or I might have it like the example that you did in class on Tuesday. The example that you did in class on Tuesday, we had a start point, which was zero. Remember, I had said set count equal to zero. Up here, I'm using counter. In the example you did, I called it CT for count. And I said count is going to start out at zero. Okay. In the example you did in class, I made the stop point six, right? So I'm saying when count, as long as counter is less than the stop point, which is six, keep going. And remember, that's what it said. It said, while counter is less than six, do it while counter was less than six. As long as counter stayed less than six, I processed. So I had a stop point of zero. I had a stop point of six. And I incremented counter. So I added one. So counter would start out at zero, and when it got this increment counter, it went up to one, and then it went up to two, and every time it hit this box that said increment counter, it added one to counter. Okay? So I start out at zero, I check and make sure that I haven't hit the stop point. If I haven't hit the stop point, I process and add one to counter. And I go back. Did I hit the stop point? No. I process, I add one and go back. Did I hit the stop point? No. Process, add one, and I keep doing that. To have a successful loop like this, you need to handle three things. You need to initialize the counter outside the loop to a specific stop point. You need to test the counter to determine whether or not the end of the loop. And you need to increment the counter inside the loop so it will change. My first job, I was writing a program, and somebody came in with a pile of papers about that thick and said, did you really want these 500 papers all saying the same person's name on it and nothing else? And I said, no. And what I had forgotten to do was I hadn't changed anything. And so I was in an endless loop. Okay? The printer ran out of paper, which is the only thing that stopped it. If the printer hadn't run out of paper, I would have gone on forever. Because I didn't change. I didn't make a change. In this case, it's increment the counter. But basically, you got to make a change. Or you'll just keep going forever. Okay? So if I say start at zero, go while it's less than six, and I never add one, then it will always be less than six, and I'll come back tomorrow and it will still be processing. Okay? And if you happen to be printing a piece of paper every time you process, you're eventually going to stop because it's going to run out of paper. Okay? So the processing, you have to have a start point, have something that says this is when you end, and you have to change the thing that is controlling the loop. In this case, counter is controlling the loop. So I have to change it so that eventually I will get out. If I don't change it, I'll be there forever. Does that make sense? I'm getting nods this time. Thank you. Okay, questions? This one, it's possible that it will never enter because I asked the question, and it may never enter. It may not enter the loop. Because if I start counter out, and counter is such that it is 7, I start a counter out at 7, then counter would be not less than stop point and it would drop out. So it's conceivable that I may not enter the loop. On this one, somebody pointed out in the last class that I really should have had equal or greater than there, and I didn't. And as I pointed out to them, if you're in this field, you got to get used to the fact that you're going to do something stupid pretty much on a regular basis, because it's just so easy to make a stupid mistake like not making a test for equal or greater than. And you just have to get used to thinking of yourself as, how could I have been that dumb? Because that's the way you're going to feel if you're in this field. Okay, so I should have made a change there. So this one, I am doing the start out at 0 again. And the stop point can be 6 again. And this time, though, I process before I check. So I will always do it at least once, because I process before I check. Okay, so I start the counter, I come down and I process. Then I add one to it, and then I check. Okay, and if I am going to get out, it will get me out. But I will have processed once before I got out. And what got us to talking about the greater than there is I said, okay, if I started the pointer out at 10, then it goes up to 11. 11 is not equal to the stop point. Okay, but 11 is equal to a greater than the stop point. And that's why I should have had the greater than in there. Okay, so that's the fundamentals of how a loop works. And we will be looking at more of those as well. Questions? Okay. The next thing I want to do is go back and start talking a little bit about some of the things in your book. And one of the things I'm going to look at is the article here that calls it programming process. And your book covers it a little differently. This says there are 5 things. I think your book says 6 or 7, but they're basically saying the same thing. So, essentially, this is what you do when you program. First, you have to clarify or define the problem. Well, that makes sense. You got to make sure you understand what it is somebody wants you to do. Okay? But it's important to do that. What I used to do is I would go to the meeting and people would explain what they wanted. And I would go back and I'd write my understanding of what I was supposed to do. And I would take it back to the people at the meeting and say to them, is this what you want? If it is, please sign it. So that I had documentation that said we were in agreement about what they wanted me to do. Because when I first started programming, I ran into too many times when people said, but I wanted you to. And I swore they didn't say that, but they said it after the fact. So I always just make sure that the person asking me to do it and I were in agreement with what had to be done. Okay? So once I got there, then I said, okay, then you start designing the program. and designing the program, they say there are three control structures. And when we go down, they talk about the three control structures. They talk about three and then they use four. But anyway, they claim they're doing three. And they are. The sequence control, we talked about that. Selection control, that's if statements. Loop control, repetition or iteration. Case structure shouldn't have been here, because case structure is another way of handling selection. It's another way of handling if statements. So in fact, I don't know why they listed that separately, because it's a subcategory under if statements. Okay? But the rest of the article was pretty good, so I forgave them. Okay, so I have to write the program. So I'm sitting down and I'm writing the program, and those are the steps that I'm using. So I write the program, I sit at the screen, write the program, and okay, so once I've designed it, and the design is usually flowchart, pseudocode, or some other tool to design it, then I write it. And once I write it, I am going to test it. Now I need to test it a load of different ways. First, I will probably make up my own data, and I will test the program using my own data, okay? And make sure that it's right. Then I need to, if my program is reading output from another program, I need to test it using output from that other program and make sure that mine reads theirs. So let's say they define an ID number as 3 characters. I define it as 5 characters. That's going to present a problem. We have to have defined the data the same way. So it's going to be a problem if we have 3 and then 5. So that problem has to be resolved. Then once I've got the program so I think it's working, I have somebody else test it. Because I'm emotionally involved in this program, I may not see some things that are problems. So you get to have somebody else test it. And then you go and you try to run it inside the system and make sure that everything, one program leads to another program, leads to another program, and that all works. And then you go live and you implement it. And once you've gone live, as soon as you go live, somebody's going to say, oh, but on the screen, if this field was next to that field, it would be so much better. Why do you have the two fields so far separated? Well, because you said it was all right. But I don't say that. I calmly go and try to fix it. And I fix it for a little while. And then after a while, you say, okay, from now on, if you have a problem, you're going to submit the paperwork and say this needs to be fixed. And every 3 months, I will look at the things that people want fixed and fix the ones that need to be fixed. Obviously, an emergency like paychecks not going out, you deal with immediately. But after a while, you get to the point that you say, we'll do maintenance on a regular basis, but we're not going to do maintenance at the snap of a finger. Okay, we'll do it when it's needed. And then after you've done maintenance, you do documentation. And everybody hates to write documentation. But you're going to leave. You're not going to be around for the life of the program. And so you need to document it so somebody else can maintain it, can follow it, can understand it. And basically, the person that picks up after you is going to either have good things to say about you or bad things to say about you, depending on your documentation and whether the program works all the time. So you want to document it enough to keep your reputation all right. And then you're done. So you document and maintain it, and from then on in, it gets maintained. You know, if you're doing something that involves federal government standards, you maintain it then. One of the biggest things that keeps programmers in business is the government changing its standards of how you withhold or how you do this or how you do that. and you have to go back and fix everything. So that's the kind of life cycle of a program that is in this article, and I think your book, if you buy it, does a very good job of describing it. Okay. The other thing I want to look at is how to compile, and that is in your book as well. So I'm going to say that I sit down and I write my program. So here's my program. And this program is called Source Code. And it is written in a high-level language, usually, not machine language. Okay, machine language is very, very, every little bit of thing is covered. So if I write in a high-level language that I want to do an ad, then it will go back and generate the machine code to do the ad. So I say in one statement I do an ad, it then generates the machine code, which involves go get this number, go get that number, do these steps to make it ad, and there's a lot of code built into it. If I ask it to read, it goes and generates miles of code as to how it goes out and reads from a file. Okay, that's very time-consuming code. So if the read has a bunch of statements that I can have everybody get when they say read, then I'm in a lot better shape. So that's what happens. I write a high-level read, it generates the machine read. Okay, I've saved a lot of time and probably I've gotten it right as opposed to making a stupid mistake somewhere along the line in it. Okay. So I write the source code and then I need to change it so that the computer can read it. And I'm going to talk about a compiler. A compiler takes and converts your program into an executable code that can be run. And it also can be done by an interpreter. And a compiler does it all at once. You give it the program, it compiles it all at once. So I give it a C program, it compiles it. An interpreter interprets for a while a few statements, and then a few more statements, and then a few more statements, and keeps giving you feedback as you go along. So a compiler acts one way, and an interpreter acts another. But both of them make things executable. So, chances are you're going to make a mistake. And so you're going to have to go and fix that mistake. And the errors that you make are syntax errors. They're errors where you misuse the language. You did something wrong. You wrote odd instead of add. Okay, that's a syntax problem. You wrote the word odd instead of the word add, and you wanted to add, or something like that. That's a syntax problem. Now, the compiler is language specific. So if I'm writing in C++, I use something that is going to compile C++. If I'm writing in Visual Basic, I use something that's going to compile Visual Basic. So it knows the language and can pick up on misuse of the language, which are syntax errors. When it finishes, it comes out with your executable program. Your program that will run, and that is called the object program. Okay? So that's your program that will run. It's met the language requirements, and it's going to run. Now you take that executable program and you load it into the computer. And you probably have some data. So you might have some data out here on the disk. You may be bringing in data from a screen. But you're probably feeding some data into the program, and the program is reading the data and working with the data. The output it's going to produce can be, I'm producing output on a screen, I'm producing output on a disk, I'm producing output on paper, whatever output you need, it's going to produce. So now you need to check the output and see if it gave you the correct output. Okay? So, for example, you're calculating a paycheck, and you meant to multiply hours worked by pay per hour, but instead you added them. Okay, you're not going to get the right pay if you add instead of multiply. And so when that output comes out and you see that the person is getting the wrong pay, you realize you've got to fix it. And the errors that come out at that point are called logic errors. I made a logical mistake. I did an add when I went to do a, meant to do a multiply. Or my if statement was wrong and didn't work. I didn't check the code correctly to find out if you were a salaried worker or an hourly worker. So it's got a logic error. So if I find logic errors, I have to take it back over here, fix the error in my program, hope that I fixed it correctly, take it over and let it compile, and it then generates the machine language or object-oriented programming, object program rather, and then it takes the object program, feeds it in, tests with the data again, and sees if I fix the problem. If I made a mistake while I was fixing it that the compiler didn't like, I'm going to have to go back and fix the syntax error. But there are two errors. The language error, misuse of the language, that's the syntax error. And logic error is, I just did something. I just did something wrong. The computer has no way of knowing that I want to multiply instead of add. It has no way of knowing what I want to do when I ask an if statement. It has no way of knowing how many times I want to do a loop. Okay, those are all logic errors. Those are errors that I make in telling the computer what to do. The computer can do them just fine. It's just I told them the wrong thing. Syntax errors are I misused the language. I spelt a word wrong. I left out a comma, I left out a semicolon, I did something. You know, there's nothing like spending 2 hours of your life looking for a comma that you forgot to put in. Or looking for an error and finding out it was a comma you forgot to put in. And we all end up having to do that. Okay? That's a syntax error. Questions? Okay, I threw a lot of stuff at you today. I would strongly suggest over the weekend that you go back and take another look at the PowerPoints and make sure that they make a little bit of sense to you. And I am done.